Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fallout with Dr. Robert Malone and myself, Yanya Kellick, senior editor at the Epoch Times. Today, we're going to look at a couple of hard-hitting articles from the Epoch Times. Number one, the CDC had evidence before it admitted it that the COVID-19 genetic vaccines could cause death. Number two, we're going to look at an unexpected side effect of these COVID-19 genetic vaccines, psychosis. A possibility. And finally, there's been these new boosters that have been put on the market, and there's a paper out there that actually looks at their effectiveness. Robert, it's great to be with you again, and I just want to remind everybody that this is a very special live Q&A episode, so make sure to put your Q&A questions in the comments, and we're going to answer a bunch of them. Hi, Robert.
So, Jan, we seem to be in a funny phase right now, a transition where information is starting to trickle out both from the federal government and from the peer-reviewed literature. Information that is frankly validating for what a lot of us, including you and I, have discussed in many prior American Thought Leaders episodes and prior Fallout episodes. And we have a recent interview from Ashish Jha that I found fascinating. Ashish Jha being the, I think he's a dean of Brown University Medical School, but he's the global coordinator for the White House for COVID. And he had some very frank comments to make the other day.
I want to talk to you a little bit about, and perhaps you can speak to it, how people are able to get help. Because it says here, as of April, just over 13,000 vaccine injury compensation claims have been filed, but to no avail. Only 19% have been reviewed. What can we do to do better with some of these folks?
Yeah, so in my mind, there are two parts of this. First of all, is we got to speed up reviews of these things. People who have been injured should not have to wait months or years to get an answer. Second is, you know, we have some traditional things we look at. We probably have to expand the definition or think about, are there new conditions that are vaccine injuries that we haven't identified before? This requires research. It requires, you know, what's really a vaccine injury, what's not. We've got to be focused on that as well. I think we just can do a lot better for these folks. It'll also help build confidence in the vaccine system, reminding people that while it's safe for most people, if you are injured, you'll get taken care of.
I think that's sort of my next question is, you know, why is it taking so long? Why isn't the government doing better? Why aren't we bringing attention to some of these people who are suffering and saying, you know, we can do better by you, and here is how we can assist you?
Yeah, I worry a little bit that what has happened is we've gotten caught in the sort of politics of this. Because as you know, there are a lot of people who've become very anti-vaccine. And so that means that a lot of doctors see these patients and worry that if they acknowledge that person's suffering, that somehow they're becoming anti-vaccine themselves. I take care of people. I remind people it doesn't matter. I'm very pro-vaccines. I got them. Everyone in my family got them. Still, I think we have to acknowledge this. That is not just happening among doctors, it's happening inside the government. We just have to do better.
I find that absolutely fascinating. And just before we continue, I want to remind our viewers that if you do have questions for Dr. Robert Malone or myself, please make sure to put them down in the comments, and we're going to be answering a bunch of them. So Robert, what do you make of it? Tell me more about what you think of this interview.
The tone is fascinating. I haven't heard anything this transparent, let's say, coming out of this White House. Remember, this goes back to the president making statements about the outcomes of those that would not take the vaccine. It was really rather harsh. And now Ashish Jha is being more open and is making a series of statements that appear to acknowledge that there has been some bias in underreporting on adverse events, consequent to physician fear of being labeled as anti-vaxxers.
I mean, and that makes sense. That's we're of course very aware of this. Is something that we've covered quite a bit, I think, over the years. Overall, right? there's this paper by Zach Stieber, or this article by Zach Stieber that we just published. And so, I mean, is it surprising that now we have this evidence from FOIAs that the CDC knew more than it admitted to? Or, you know, what do you think?
It's not surprising to me. I've known that the FDA and the CDC knew about myocarditis and the shingles incidents and many other adverse events for quite a long time. And in a prior series, Zach and another colleague did a great job documenting the history and timeline of the CDC withholding informed consent, because that's what it really comes down to, withholding information about the myocarditis and the long timeline associated with that of them having that documentation and refusing to acknowledge that risk in public and often kind of gaslighting or downplaying the risk of myocarditis. And now in a complimentary article that he's published the following day, also withholding information about death, that happened in the case of two adolescents or young men, and there was very active suppression of the manuscript or attempts to suppress the publication of a manuscript written by those that had been involved in making the determination of the cause of death, the autopsies, that involved some CDC testing. But it, based on Zach's reporting, it appears that the CDC has more than just withheld information about the association between death and these genetic vaccines, but it has actively suppressed publications and information coming from non-CDC physicians that have been reporting autopsy results or other findings having to do with cause of death. And that loops back to the other thing. You know, I mean, there's a number of kind of amazing truth bombs in Zach's article. One is that the CDC is refusing to accept a independent physician determination of the cause of death, in many cases through autopsy, in which there was specific statements made by the diagnosing physician that fills out the death certificate, who legally has the responsibility for making the determination on cause of death. And these physicians and pathologists had listed vaccine-associated, in many cases, vaccine-associated myocarditis as the cause of death. And then the CDC refused to accept that diagnosis of cause of death in their official tabulations. So it appears that we now, through Epic Times' work in Freedom of Information Act requests, have literally the documentation to engage in hyperbole, but literally the smoking gun concerning the willingness and methods and ability of the CDC to withhold information about death-related adverse events. And this isn't just with the RNA vaccines. It also includes the side effects associated with the J&J vaccine product, the adenovirus vector product, which included this interesting and somewhat perplexing clinical finding of idiopathic thrombocytopenic thrombosis, or ITP, which is this kind of blotchy red bruising-like that appears on some patient's skin. I have a person that's worked on the farm, Mason, that had that, for instance. It's not that rare, but they assert that it is extremely rare. And this is observed with and reported by the CDC found by the CDC, according to the documentation that Zach's obtained. This is associated with the J&J product. It happens to be exactly the same syndrome that has triggered a large legal case in the United Kingdom right now against AstraZeneca. And strangely, AstraZeneca is denying that there's any relationship between this large legal case that it looks like they're going to lose and withdrawing their product from the vaccine. The J&J product had already been withdrawn.
Right.
From the market, but now AstraZeneca is going to be withdrawn in Europe and in the UK, also for this same syndrome and death. Again, to reinforce, deaths associated with the vaccine, which the CDC withheld information from the public on.
I'm going to jump to actually a live Q&A before we continue, because I want to kind of bring in our viewers. So, related, but more extensive, I suppose. Chester Brown asks, all of this sounds like a very coordinated effort by the CDC, this administration, the media, and Big Pharma. Is this grounds for a RICO investigation?
So RICO refers to the Racketeering and Corrupt Activities Act. Which was originally set up for basically going after mafia and other coordinated activities that are breaking the law in a kind of a group activity. So if you were going to think about taking a RICO approach, and I'm not a lawyer, that would imply that there was some specific coordination between these various parties. And I think we have to be careful about jumping to conclusions about coordinating activities between pharma and the government or potential conspiracies. That's always a possibility. I think we need to acknowledge that. But there are other reasons why government employees might want to withhold this kind of information in a coordinated way. Remember that at the CDC, they have, like many federal agencies, a dual purpose. In the case of vaccines, they're supposed to monitor vaccine safety, and they also have a specific mission to promote vaccine. Of course, not surprisingly, the budget to promote vaccines is much larger than the budget to monitor vaccines. And so there's this tension within the CDC and many other branches of government between those that are tasked with being the truth tellers about potential risks and those that are tasked with promoting the whatever the industry is or the field. And so sometimes the kind of the bureaucracy and the structure of these agencies can lead to what appears to be a coordinated effort that benefits their industry, but they are likely to take the position that they're just acting in accordance with their congressional mandate. So I think we have to be careful about assuming that there's racketeering or corrupt activities involving coordination between government officials and, for instance, the pharmaceutical industry. That's not to say that it isn't happening one way or another, but I think we have to be cautious about jumping to conclusions and prosecuting a RICO case in something like this. From what I hear from the attorneys, would be extremely difficult.
Right. And I mean, I think what I hear you saying, if I've got this right, is that if the incentive structure is set up and a lot of different groups or agencies all kind of stack in the same direction, it might create the illusion of coordination where there isn't any, assuming the incentive structures weren't coordinated in the first place, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. It's really complex, and it's just a minefield of conflicts and complexity. And in no way do I want to downplay the possibility that there was coordination. I'm just cautioning not to jump to that conclusion, and acknowledging what I learned from the attorneys, which is a case like that would be very difficult to bring against a U.S. government agency in this time and with these kinds of mandates. I just very much doubt that we would see this Justice Department or anyone else interested in pursuing a RICO type action.
You know, there was another paper that Zach Stieber followed up with. The headline was, you know, Inside the Study That Shook the CDC. This was a study that detailed the sudden deaths of two teenagers. And you drew a kind of continuity here between this one.
Yeah, because they're both speaking to, let's say gently, the underlying culture of the CDC and how they've approached COVID-19. And Zach in his articles points out that there's kind of a two opposite approaches being taken. In the case of potential vaccine harms, there seems to be the assumption that there's the appearance of a very strong bias within the CDC to denying any adverse event or death associated with the vaccines. And paradoxically, on the other side, a really strong bias towards assigning death to anything that has a PCR positive signal for COVID disease, for infection by the virus. So in the case of the virus, a strong bias towards reporting death or disease associated with a PCR signal. And on the other side, a very strong bias to underreporting death and disease in anyone that has no PCR signal, but has received the vaccine product within 45 days. That's the other thing, is they keep that window for 45 days. Whereas, as Zach points out, in the case of the infection, if there is any prior history of PCR evidence, and I'm saying this because most of our audience will recognize those PCR tests are questionable in terms of their positive predictive value and specificity, but there seems to be a willingness to attribute death events to infection even beyond 45 days after infection. So that's really what this is coming down to, is how, in retrospect, how do we look at the data that have come from the CDC? How do we interpret those data, both in terms of the vaccine and the infection? Because the appearance is that there is some real reporting biases going on that have completely distorted public policy.
Right. I mean, you're suggesting that the deaths due to the virus itself are kind of overreported according to this, and in the opposite direction when it comes to the
which
to
is something I said, you know, years ago now on Rogan, made the point that anybody who could be detected as having a positive PCR signal that was being hospitalized would be determined to be hospitalized consequent to the infection.
Right.
And so that resulted in a huge reporting bias, positive reporting bias, for death and disease associated with SARS-CoV-2, which doesn't fit with the all-cause mortality data. That's the big paradox here, is we had all of this discussion about a huge wave of, I'm going to say the big words, morbidity and mortality, or sickness and death associated with SARS-CoV-2, and yet, in retrospect, when we look at all-cause mortality, all causes of death in the United States and in Europe and in the Western world, we would expect to see a big surge of increased mortality across the board with the onset of the infection, but we don't see that. We see a flat line compared to prior years, about running about the same, because people die, until the rollout of some of the pharmaceutical and non-pharmaceutical interventions. I'm using very careful language there, but some might infer that that sudden surge in all-cause mortality that was noted by the insurance actuaries seems to correlate with the onset of the vaccine campaigns and the vaccine mandates in particular. So that's highly suggestive that it wasn't the virus, it was something else. And that something else could include the vaccines.
So, you know, a question was queued up for me here, which is sort of the perfect follow-up here, and given how much we're talking about the virus. And so Leonora Perron asks, some say that there is no such thing as a virus, that it is merely a computer calculation, and there's no photograph of one, only drawings and cartoons. True or false?
False. I acknowledge that there is a community that has this belief system. This kind of relates to the overall problem of what is truth and what is reality. In fact, there are multiple images of coronaviruses, SARS-CoV-2, SARS-CoV-1. The viruses are isolated. I mean, we just had a lengthy discussion in the House concerning the origin of the virus itself and whether or not it was engineered at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And I find it amazing and perplexing that we've had this theme emerge that there are no such things as viruses and no such thing as SARS-CoV-2. When in fact there's an abundance of evidence that both things are false. But some people have belief systems that are very resistant to data. And this is one of the problems, I think, with reliance on social media for information.
Well, I mean, the challenge is, right, when there's a lot of, let's say, falsehood among the, you know, established sources of information that are supposed
Absolutely.
To be conveying truth.
Absolutely.
You know, you go to where you think you can find it. And of course, and then you have a mix.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was asked on a podcast the other day, how do you tell who's telling you the truth and who isn't? And in this environment in which we've come to lose faith in experts, that faith that we had developed as a community, as a culture over decades and hundreds of years now has been compromised. And that leaves us in kind of a post-truth environment where all truths are considered to be equivalent, and there's a rejection of credentialism or credentialed expertise. And I can understand why that would be the case, given what we've seen.
You know, there's actually kind of two. There's a related question, right? The first question is, do viruses exist at all? I think that's what this question was,
yeah.
Right? The second question, which is related, which I'm kind of ad-libbing, which I've heard about too, is, you know, people will argue that the, at least in the West, the harm, right, the death was primarily iatrogenic, a big word, you know, basically caused by
physician caused.
Right?
Yeah, physician caused or hospital caused is iatrogenic.
Right. So in that sense, you know, they'll say, well, it wasn't really the virus. It was something else, right? Kind of like what you said earlier. So how does that square up?
So both things can be true. The issue there, and that's one of my challenges in communicating in this space with people that are very passionate about this topic, is that when you look at the macro level, you know, up at the 40,000 foot view, you're looking at all cause mortality. It's really hard to make the case that we have data from looking at all causes of death, which is the only metric that seems to not have been contaminated by interest of various parties and, you know, and conflicting agendas. You don't see a surge in all cause mortality. Now, that doesn't mean that people didn't get sick from this virus. And the people that are in the none of this was the virus and the virus was false, and that's a false narrative camp, seem to disregard morbidity or sickness and only focus on mortality or death. One of the derivatives of that is that they assert that these physicians that have been providing early treatment are all charlatans, are misrepresenting that, in fact, there was no mortality, and these physicians that provided early treatment are claiming that they saved lives when, in fact, there's no evidence. The counterargument to that is, well, there was actually a strong cohort of physicians that was out there that basically blunted or mitigated the death wave by providing early treatment. And I find this whole argument really perplexing. It's caused a lot of pain and anger. But I can't deny that when you just look at death from a high level and disregard sickness, which is not the normal case when you're evaluating this type of epidemiology data, but the people that are making these cases are often mathematicians or data analyst specialists, not medical or epidemiologic professionals. They're saying, well, we're not seeing the death. It's not there. Therefore, the death only, we can see the death starting after some of these non-pharmaceutical and pharmaceutical interventions start, particularly the vaccine. And therefore, it's all iatrogenic or physician and hospital caused. It's not viral caused.
Well, and I'll just make one comment here. You know, the people who we know who are clinicians, people who are running big ERs, you know, and there's multiple people like this who decided to, let's call it, buck the system and not follow the standard protocols.
Right. They were a subset, but they had a significant impact.
But all of them will tell you, right, that no, there was a virus that came in. I mean, there was something new that came in that we had to treat, and it looked really bad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, so this is such an interesting point that there's, you know, people that are looking at things purely from the perspective of data, and they could be, you know, like top epidemiologists or something like that. And there's people that are dealing with people coming in very sick with low, oxygen saturation,
exactly,
and everything. And they're trying to figure out how to deal with it.
Yep.
Right. And it's just a completely different experience of the same phenomenon.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what underpins this. And it's tearing apart communities, frankly, of scientists and physicians and others that are all concerned and focused on the COVID crisis and how it was managed, because they're all kind of shooting at each other over the nuances of how you interpret this tension between the macro level data and the kind of street level data of what medical professionals encountered as they were practicing. I think it's a tragedy that you know, when we have so many other things to worry about, so many other sources of conflict, that we're busy at each other's throats over whether or not there actually was a virus, or the whether or not those that provided early treatment were deluding themselves and their patients in some way, which is what's being asserted. Extremely destructive.
Let me jump to another question from the live Q&A folks. Taxpaying American. I think this one's for me. Would Epoch Times create a publicly accessible online archive with all documentation that they have assembled over the years? So, I mean, I think I'm not 100% sure what the question is asking. I'll answer as best I can. We're going to keep all of our work publicly accessible. And in many cases, that work has links to the original documentation, if that's what you're asking about. If you're asking, are we planning to create a book out of it or some kind of giant set of volumes? We don't have plans of that nature at the moment. You know, digitally. Some of it is in the newspaper, those that have been collecting those. But maybe perhaps taxpaying American, if you would like to kind of expand a little bit on what you're asking, we'll look in the comments and try to answer.
Can I comment on this?
Sure.
In my experience, I'm able to use the search tool within Epoch Times online edition to find prior articles. But I think to acknowledge the commenter, there, I have seen a pattern with other publications of revised articles, kind of a retrospective historic revisions going on, and also key articles and references. We're running into this with our book on Cywar, where references that we had cited as we're now finishing it up, we're going back and checking the references, and a number of them are gone. You just can't find them. I was talking to somebody the other day who is very knowledgeable about the Internet Archive tools and told that, yes, in fact, the Wayback Machine is making some articles disappear upon government pressure. This is somebody that's very linked to the Kennedy campaign and very knowledgeable about Silicon Valley. And in fact, they are making articles disappear under government pressure, but that they're not actually deleting them. They're just making them no longer visible. And if a different administration was to come through with different priorities, they could flip the switch and make those available. But I think the concerns about this kind of retrospective rewriting of history has a lot of merit. And in a way, he's respecting Epoch Times by suggesting that there would be merit of somehow creating a collection of the historic documents that you've generated.
That's very interesting. Well, anyway, thank you for the question, and it's a great idea. And, you know, just as another comment, I've been looking at some other media sources, more mainstream media sources recently, and I found lots of evidence, not necessarily specifically around COVID and so forth, of actual stealth editing of content leading to dramatically different kind of information being there without disclosing that such an edit was made. And this is very bizarre, because, you know, you really think of Orwell here, right? Where you rewrite history as if
Ministry of Truth, as if
what was there was something different. So I hadn't thought of it from that perspective, just because I find the idea so abhorrent, frankly. Everyone makes mistakes. You correct them and you acknowledge that you made them as best you can. But to do that is a whole different world mentality, and I think a dark path. So, all right. Before I go to the next question, I really want to talk to about Avin Apathuli's article on looking at this new side effect that I hadn't been aware of from these COVID-19 genetic vaccines, which is
psychosis,
exactly. Right. I was going to say something else, but yes, no, precisely. And that it's hard to, it doesn't go away quickly, as I understand it.
And what this peer-reviewed publication is documenting. Now, let's be clear. This is not a prospective randomized trial or any of the larger, more rigorous. This is a collection of case studies that they've reviewed and find certain common features in those case studies. It's a fairly large collection, but it's not a prospective randomized trial. In the paper, they're identifying that there's two kinds of this psychosis: hallucinations and delusions. Auditory hallucinations are particularly common. To me, what's particularly worrying about this is that we're having psychosis, including hallucinations and delusions, in people who are mandated to take these products. And this includes first responders, healthcare personnel. Remember, virtually all hospital personnel were forced to take the products. In particular, military personnel. So we've had products administered to crucial infrastructure people that are causing them to have mental conditions, detectable mental conditions.
Well, and I just want to jump in for a moment and say, we don't know the frequency and it's not.
Precisely.
Right.
Good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Like crucial point.
Right.
There's still that there's nothing in this article that speaks to frequency and prevalence. And the fact that it's a modest collection of these cases suggests that it's relatively rare. So that's absolutely a valid point.
Well, but the point is yet another area that we should obviously begets the need for research and exploration, given how many of these things were given out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And as you pointed out at the beginning, so they're treating these people with steroids and only about half of them are recovering. The other half still have persistent effects post-treatment. So it seems to be relatively intractable, resistant to the little bit of treatment that is known as an option. And of course, there's up till now been virtually no investigations in terms of the cause of this, how to mitigate it or reduce the probability, and how to treat it.
Yeah, and frankly, it's new for me. Like I just wasn't aware that this.
And yet, to be fair, psychosis was also a feature of the viral infection. Chris Cuomo lately is in quite a bit. He's got his own show, right? And he's acknowledged that he has his own vaccine damage. And that's been featured in a lot of press articles. And if you reel back in time and remember when he became infected with SARS-CoV-2, with COVID, when he was broadcasting from CNN, he stayed home and he acknowledged that he was having psychotic symptoms. He was having hallucinations, overt hallucinations. And kept broadcasting through it. It was an amazing kind of series. But let's remember that these kinds of findings were also seen with the viral infection.
Well, and so then it's not necessarily surprising, if assuming it's the spike that's
you just said the key word. Right. You made an assumption, but let's call it a hypothesis.
Right.
That and we know that spike can affect brain function. We know it's associated with neural inflammation. It's certainly associated with microvascular coagulation or small vessel blood clots. So as you point out, not too stunning that you would see these kinds of symptoms in people that have received a product that would cause their body to make large amounts of this protein that I assert is a toxin, that being the biologically engineered spike.
All right, let's jump to another question. I think we've got about 20 minutes left in the show, so let's focus on mostly the Q&As, and we may look into
Great.
This paper that's related to
the Cleveland Clinic paper is fascinating.
We'll get you to summarize it in a bit. But okay, so this is Bakley T. How concerned should Medicare patients be that future vaccine compliance is tied to insurance coverage?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that it is certainly something to be alerted to. How concerned should you be? We saw withholding of medical care, including transplantation, from people who had not accepted these COVID vaccines, as you'll recall.
Yeah.
So clearly there's precedent for policy in which medical treatment and care would be withheld if one was not compliant. I hear story after story these days of pediatricians firing their patients and their parents because of lack of compliance with the CDC vaccine schedule. And some have speculated that this has to do with the financial incentives provided to pediatricians to have a certain fraction of their total pediatric population fully vaccinated according to schedule. So there's, you know, how concerned should you be that there would be a kind of a litmus test as a recipient of federal healthcare practice, you know, insurance, that you would only be eligible if you were fully compliant with the vaccine schedule? I think there's merit to that. And I think that that's a potential policy that people should be very alerted to, and I hope would communicate to their representatives that they would find this intolerable.
All right, let's go to PM Kane 0312. Would ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine be effective with early use in any of the possible viruses that may be thrown at us?
I have to be cautious in answering this, but I'm going to be fairly blunt. The data indicate that both of those agents have effectiveness against a wide range of viral diseases. Those are the data that I've seen, and those are consistent with my own private findings when I was collaborating with leading researchers in the U.S. Army in trying to identify repurposed drugs for various viral diseases. So I'm not in any way advocating that you go out and buy a stockpile of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine in the event that you might get exposed to bird flu. I'm just citing the current fear that's being circulated and promoted. If for no other reason that stockpiling antivirals or antibiotics can result in you having stuff on the shelf that's expired. That's a common problem. And self-treating, over-treating, risking potential toxicities, etc. But I think that in the future, I hope that physicians and the federal government infrastructure will be more open to actively investigating and listening to frontline physicians about whether those agents or other repurposed drugs are effective in mitigating the disease risk associated with these various infectious diseases. Remember that it's not necessary for a drug to kill or treat the pathogen, because in many cases you can mitigate the disease by reducing the overamped inflammatory response to those pathogens. What gets you with COVID, and frontline physicians will tell you this, is often not the first wave. When you initially get infected, that's bad if you have risk factors like I did. But then you go into kind of a quiet phase for a couple of days. And then there's a inflammatory phase where basically your body is overreacting to viral antigens and other debris and signals. And so that seems, for instance, with the use of steroids, that's what's being knocked down, is that reactive phase. My point is that it's, we hear again and again, well, that agent isn't proven to be an antiviral. So what? If the agent is observed by frontline physicians to be useful in reducing the disease and improving the outcomes, as far as I'm concerned, that's what matters, not whether or not it kills the virus.
Well, that reminds me of something that was up, I think, when this Jicky Leaks Twitter account promoted it for a while. This was
Jicky is quite perceptive.
Well, it was this idea that the two hashtag two tablets, right? And I think it was azithromycin. Basically, there's this post-viral
syndrome
infection, right? Yeah. That happens. And if you were to treat that, right, but you weren't allowed to do that in hospital. But if you were to have treated that, that would have reduce the deaths.
And I think that that a lot of these early treatment protocols had, for instance, Pierre Corey's initial presentation to Ron Johnson in the U.S. Senate and testimony wasn't about ivermectin. It was about the use of steroids, which at the time was heresy and has now become normative in treating the disease. Because, of course, it's an inverted logic. If you're shutting down the inflammatory response, you would think that would lead to worse disease if the ability of the inflammatory response to kill the virus was what was important. But as Pierre observed, and many others observed clinically, empirically, by tamping down that inflammatory response, you really improved the disease outcome, because the disease outcome had more to do with that hyperinflammatory response, which is what Jicky, I think, was pointing out.
Right. I think it was azithromycin and zinc. I think, if I recall, that was the idea.
That's an interesting pairing. The Dieter Raut protocol was hydroxychloroquine and zinc, it was azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine, I think, was what he was promoting. That also had some kind of obscure sideways activity. There was a lot of those kind of dual tablet protocols that surfaced. And what it underscores is that the truth is that if you got on this thing early, there's a lot of different drugs that were effective, not just hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. A lot of different drug protocols were designed by physicians all over the world. That were effective if you got it early. And that's what was so discouraging about the position taken by many hospitals, that patients would come in and present with symptoms, and they would be essentially sent home with equivalent of aspirin, a mild over-the-counter anti-inflammatory, and told to come back when they were in severe respiratory distress, ergo when your lips are blue, which just is counterintuitive. And I think that in particular is what upsets a lot of the frontline physicians that were giving early treatment.
And I think this was the argument. The argument was that if you weren't, for some reason, you know, we know that the diagnostic methods were highly problematic, using, you know, PCR as a diagnostic tool. And so if you weren't diagnosed with COVID, you would get treated with something that would actually help getting rid of the bacteria.
Yeah, that was the paradox, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's just kind of litigating back. But I think that's what that idea that I was mentioning, I hope I got it right, was getting at. But let me jump to another question here. I think this is actually quite interesting. This is Carmel Gu. How do I convince surgeons I work with that the COVID shot is causing health problems such as Graves' disease, thyroid eye disease, menstrual problems, et cetera?
That's a tough one. That gets to the Ashish Jha clip that we played earlier on, where surgeons or other medical health professionals have there has been developed, because of much of the messaging that has been promoted, that if you express any concerns about adverse events associated with these products, then you're labeled as an anti-vaxxer. Which is a pejorative and can be a career ender. If you're a licensed medical professional, you're at risk for losing your license if you're so labeled. So how are you going to convince somebody whose livelihood depends on their medical license and their reputation to acknowledge the possibility of something that could severely damage their ability to practice their profession?
You know, I think that we actually have a tool, and you just mentioned it. I mean, there's this video right now. You can say, hey, look, this is the, you know, as the mainstream of mainstream, you know, medical advisors.
Yeah. I'm going to share a personal anecdote. The other day I went in for an echocardiogram to my local hospital. And the very experienced technician that ran that, by the way, I had a good outcome. Brooke Miller tells me that I'm within normal range. So yay. We were concerned. But this is the second time I've been into that hospital over the span of a year and a half for cardiac issues. And in both cases, the technicians have quietly, once the doors were closed, spoken to me because they recognize my name, spoken to me about what they're observing in the medical system, how disappointed they are, failure of the medical system to act with integrity and acknowledge what's going on. My point is that patients, and they did so because they felt comfortable. They already knew what my position was because I'm so public about it. And so they felt comfortable coming out and kind of acknowledging their own concerns and observations. And I get a lot of that. But the average patient that walks through, why would a physician open up to that person? There's so many disincentives right now. And I think that's one of the most... It is one of the great tragedies of how the COVID crisis has been handled and the role of media propaganda and censorship, delisting, demonetizing, all those things that we've talked about here previously have really damaged the ability of the medical profession to acknowledge reality, which is exactly what Ashish Shah is speaking to in that clip. To his credit.
You know, this is a topic for another follow-up episode, I suppose, but, you know, there's this, you know, the aftermath of situations where a lot of stuff went wrong and a lot of people are, you know, could be held accountable and would like to avoid held accountable, right? These kinds of situations. I mean, this is something I've been looking at for years, especially, for example, emerging out of communist societies is another scenario like that. And how do you deal with that? And there's actually perhaps some lessons to be learned, like say for a future follow-up episode, but there's things that seem to work and there's things that seem to not work, and sort of, you know, treating people in the harshest possible way, just looking back at it now historically, what happened post 1989 to my eye doesn't actually seem to work. I'm saying the guilty parties, like, because so many people are complicit, this is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Sure, there might be a few people that need to be specifically, you know, sort of held accountable, but there's so many people are complicit, and so many people even not knowingly at the beginning, right? Or so on. How do you actually deal with that? Topic for another episode. Let me try to get one more question in, and we also need to touch on this this paper, the Cleveland Clinic paper, exactly. Well, I'll have to. I'll do this one. I don't know how you'll answer it, but Chris Hamper asks, I'm a 77-year-old female with MS. I took 2 Pfizer shots and then stopped. How could I be affected negatively?
So she's asking an open-ended question. Hypothetically, how could she be affected? And the honest truth is she could have many kinds of adverse events. She's could be affected by the full spectrum of what we now know to be adverse events. She may have some increased risk for some of those, particularly those involving neuroinflammation, because she already has multiple sclerosis. So she could see an acceleration of that, for example. It's important to remember, to her, speaking to her particularly, she's taken the product twice, and she's not reporting that she's currently experiencing those adverse events. Presumably, she took the product a while ago, so she's the probability is high that she's out of the woods in terms of her risk profile. And I think it's important to not scare people inappropriately, and to acknowledge that when we speak about these adverse events, including death, they're relatively infrequent. We can argue about how frequent they are, and myocarditis seems to be more frequent. Subclinical myocarditis might even be up to 50% based on some analyses having to do with blood enzymes. But for many of these things, like we're talking about the psychosis, et cetera, they're relatively rare. So she's not experiencing things right now, even the turbo cancer. Is a rare event. If she's not experiencing things now after a while, after having taken these two products, she's probably okay. Now that is a perfect segue into our next paper, which speaks to the issue of, are the boosters working? And are there any problems in terms of your risk of developing COVID if you take multiple doses of this of these products? I'm hesitating to call them vaccines because their ability to prevent infection is quite modest. We're the arm wrestling right now is whether or not they're active in reducing your risk of disease or death. And it's important to remember that they're not licensed. When the FDA provided emergency use authorization and the license, prevention of disease and death was not listed as one of the reasons, one of the indications for these products. They were licensed for prevention of infection, and they don't do that. I was called a liar by the Washington Post for saying so, but this next paper really documents that. You want to jump into that?
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Do you have the title listed there? I don't have it with me.
I'll pull it up right now.
It's what's important to note about this one is it's a preprint. So it's not yet peer reviewed, but it's coming from one of the elite medical institutions in the United States, the Cleveland Clinic.
So the title is Effectiveness of the 2022-24 Formulation of the Coronavirus Disease 2019 mRNA Vaccine Against the JN.1 Variant. Very specific title.
Very precise. Yeah. And I think in it's that I would call that a defensive title. Mm-hmm. They're being very careful about how they're wording that and what they're saying, because they know they're going to get raked over the coals by the reviewers. Remember, this is a preprint. This is a study of employees of the Cleveland Clinic. It's 47,561 employees of the Cleveland Clinic have been enrolled in this study. I hope they all gave informed consent. So it is a prospective study. They're looking forward in time. They said, we're going to do this study. We're going to enroll these people. We're going to look at this outcome. And by the way, the outcome was basically PCR positive signal. So we all understand at this point that PCR positive signal has a lot of artifact issues. But that was the endpoint. Did you develop a PCR positive signal as a surrogate for being infected by SARS-CoV-2 after you received the jab, the booster jab that was formulated for XBB strain viruses? And as I predicted way back then when they were rolling it out, XBB at the time they rolled it out was already extinct. It had been replaced by other lineages. And to their credit, when they did this assessment, for everybody that came up with a positive PCR signal, they determined which virus strain they were infected by. And they were all infected by this JN1 variant, which is not an XBB. Okay, so this is a heterologous, it's the technical term we use in virology, okay? It's akin to a heterologous challenge. They're getting infected by one virus strain that's different from what the boosters were designed from. It was determined to be 23% effective in preventing by one form analysis in preventing a PCR positive signal. In there, this is also fun, 18% of their employees took the booster. This is at the Cleveland Clinic, 18% uptake of the booster among Cleveland Clinic employees. That's kind of a stunning little buried fact within this study. In order to detect that 23% effectiveness, they had to carefully adjust for confounding variables. If they didn't adjust for confounding, and sometimes adjusting for confounding variables can introduce bias. Okay, so if they didn't adjust for confounding variables, they saw no effect associated with vaccination. Okay, so it's modest. But the stunning thing, and this is the eighth study to demonstrate this. This is not a you know, anomalous outlier finding. The risk of COVID-19 was higher after three or more doses than in the unvaccinated. So this gets the negative effectiveness that is being observed in many of these studies, where the multiple inoculated actually are the ones that are at highest risk for developing disease. It's worth with actually reading the conclusion statement from this, because there's a whole lot of fascinating nuance. Although some individuals are at risk of complications of COVID-19 and may benefit from receiving a vaccine frequently, the wisdom of vaccinating everyone with a vaccine of low effectiveness, remember this is from the Cleveland Clinic, a vaccine of low effectiveness every few months to prevent what is generally a mild or an asymptomatic infection, they're talking about, in most healthy persons, needs to be questioned. In conclusion, this study found an overall low protective effect of the 2023-2024 formula COVID-19 vaccine against infection with the JN1 lineage, while also finding a higher number of prior vaccine doses was associated with a higher risk of COVID-19. Now remember that in many schools, this is still a mandated product. In the childhood vaccine schedule, the CDC is still recommending this product, these boosters. The federal government and the CDC are still promoting these. And yet these are the data. Sorry, Washington Post, it's not working. And I think that we can trust the Cleveland Clinic and a study of 47,561 employees as giving us a pretty good indicator that the product is not meeting expectations.
And just very briefly, you know, what were you thinking when you said that the buried hidden finding is that only 18%? Is it only 18%, or is that a lot?
In an environment in which there is strong positive incentives to take the vaccine, you know, working in a hospital, most medical students are still required to take the jab. There's strong positive incentives to take the product, and yet still less than 20% of these hospital employees were willing to take the booster. To me, that's stunning, because these are the people that are encountering patients on a daily basis that are the most informed about whether or not these products are working and their potential risk. Even a mildly effective product with low or no risk, which is pretty much what the CDC says officially, is that these are safe. In a healthcare environment, even a partially effective vaccine with little or no risk, I would expect to have a pretty robust uptake, you know, 60, 80%. But here we have well less than 20% at one of the leading medical complexes in the United States, the Cleveland Clinic.
Well, and I mean, it's been years now since I remember I had you on the show and you advocated for having these products be withdrawn, and I'm pretty sure you haven't changed your view on this.
Well, thanks for reminding. People forget that I was one of the first to come out and say that, as was the group that I used to tour with, referred to as the PHA group. We did a whole thing on Del Bigtree's studio where we called for withdrawal many years ago now. And of course, it was disregarded. But here we are.
And that conclusion is very interesting language, which suggests, some sort of shifting. It's pretty definitive. It's about as definitive as I've heard in
from a major medical institution. Right. We've kind of bookended this session, this segment, with Ashish Shah at the beginning, and now this statement from the Cleveland Clinic. I think that there is a increasing openness to acknowledging the overstatement of risk associated with SARS-CoV-2, which is explicitly said here. I mean, that's one of the things that's a little bit stunning to me. To prevent what is generally a mild or an asymptomatic infection in most healthy persons. That's that was heresy to say that a year or 2 years ago. And now it's coming out of a mainstream medical institution. So it's as if some semblance of reality is kind of being allowed. I get the feedback fairly frequently now that I've been validated, which gives me no comfort. That a lot of the things that you and I discussed so long ago have and were resoundingly criticized for saying have now been verified. There's some peace, I think, in seeing that you and I and so many others that stuck our necks out are now being perceived as truth tellers at a time when telling truth was not very popular.
Hopefully a little bit more, at least.
Right? Yeah. A modicum.
Yeah. But anyway, I think that's it. I think we've kind of overshot our planned time a little bit. We're going to do more for the benefit of everybody. We are going to do more of these Q&As in the future. I asked, I think, one of the users to please kind of add a follow-up to your question. I'm going to look for that and I'll answer it. I don't know, any final quick thought, Robert?
Be good. Take your vitamin D and zinc, and please come back and join us next week on Fallout.